From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. For years, the advice has been the same. For a healthy heart, eat less red meat. And then, 2 weeks ago, an international panel of scientists released a bomb, a report that they said overturned that prevailing wisdom. In fact, they said it was based on poor quality science and that eating red meat didn't really make much of a difference at all. That study has garnered lots of headlines and sparked plenty of criticism and controversy. And my next guest says that that high-profile disagreement and conflicting advice could itself do more harm than any specific recommendation. Scott Lear is professor and chair of cardiovascular prevention research at Simon Fraser University, and he wrote about the perils of flip-flopping nutrition science for TheConversation.com. Welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thanks, Heather. It's my pleasure.
It's pretty rare that one study could overturn an entire field of research, but this was not just, you know, a new experiment. Explain what this new study was that was released and how they came to this conclusion that maybe eating less red meat is not such a health issue.
Yes, certainly. This study is actually what I would call a review of studies. So a study of studies, and it was taking a group of other research that had looked at the health implications of eating red meat, both processed and unprocessed red meat, and combining them together and seeing what the result was. Now, the finding that they had did show a small increased risk for red meat if somebody was to, let's say, cut down from 3 servings a week. So if you're eating 7 servings a week and went down to 4 a week, that would actually, there is actually some suggested benefit, even from this study. But the authors were saying that that benefit was too small, and the studies that look at that type of research are of poor quality to justify saying on a population level, we should eat less meat.
Dig into that a little bit more. When you say of poor quality, specifically what was wrong with all of those studies? I mean, this is a review of all of the science, and to kind of paint broadly and say it's all of pretty poor quality, what was actually wrong with it?
Well, nutrition science is messy. The waters are very muddy. And the predominant way of doing research in nutrition sciences in terms of foods that we eat is to ask somebody what food they ate. Maybe it was types of foods that they ate in the last week or in the last year. And then follow them up maybe 5, 10 years, 15 years later and look at individual items that people self-reported said that they ate and look how their health was 10, 15 years later. So there's like that's a commonly accepted research study design, but it relies on people remembering what they ate. It relies on people remembering how much they ate, and also sometimes it relies on how they prepared the meal. And then you're taking that information and thinking that this is going to be relevant 10, 15 years later. So there's a lot of factors in there that can make things all kind of messy. People can change their diet. People cannot remember what they're eating. The other thing is it actually reduces our whole diet into one item. So in this case, looking at meat, or in other cases, looking at fruits and vegetables or fish. But we don't eat like meat in isolation. We might eat meat with certain foods and fish with certain foods.
Yeah. But this kind of study of studies, this meta study that just came out a couple of weeks ago, is something that in recent years, we've heard is kind of the gold standard. It can give us a sense of the weight of evidence, as we were just talking about, the quality of evidence for a certain conclusion. As someone who studies, you know, cardiovascular disease prevention is your expertise. At this point, having seen this meta study, would you say eat all the red meat you want?
No, I certainly wouldn't say that. And the other thing, too, is just because our study methodologies may be wrong or may not be great, it doesn't mean that it's not uncovering a true finding. But our confidence in it may not be as strong.
Well, Scott Lear, there's clearly a lot of open questions still here about the health impacts of eating various different amounts of red meats. Why is it that you think the public seeing this back and forth and the conflicting results and this kind of scientific debate play out, why is that potentially such a problem?
Well, because it sends a confusing message. And there is, even last year, there were a couple studies within a few months of each other. One showed that egg intake was bad for us, and another showed that egg intake didn't matter. And this kind of thing about eggs has been going on for quite a while as well. And I hear a lot of comments, and even some comments on the article that I wrote that says, people saying, I've just stopped listening to this advice and eat what I want. Nutritional scientists are very emotional as well, maybe emotionally attached to their food choices. And that can sometimes get in the way of kind of like, okay, what is the truth?
But is this a problem of the science and the scientific method that's being applied here, or the way that's being translated? I mean, rarely would a scientist say this one study answers every question and you should base your life on this one study, right? It should be that weight of evidence, years of studies. Okay, what are the trends that we see? And part of the endeavor of science is to take those conflicting results and not just say, you're right, I'm wrong, whatever, but also to figure out why they got those different results and learn from that. So, you know, that doesn't to me seem like an unhealthy thing for science to do, but maybe more a problem of how we're interpreting that and putting it into play.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a mix of both. The study that came out a couple weeks ago, it didn't come to a different conclusion, but it said that this risk, which was 8%, which is quite small. It's also hard to translate those numbers into meaningful impact. And that was for reducing your weekly intake of meat by 3 servings. And whereas something simple, if you've got somebody who isn't exercising and they start doing 20 minutes of walking a day for a week, well, over about a 10-year period, you're going to have decreased that person's risk of dying by 20%. So it's a lot easier to see those numbers than it is with the diet study. So in part of it is the methodology. And yes, you're correct that when we see a group of studies kind of in the same direction, then we're more confident. In this case, the authors of that saw kind of, yes, there is a small risk for eating meat, but is it warranted to tell people just from a health point of view to reduce their meat? And then it just becomes like where that becomes problematic is it becomes an argument of opinions of looking at the same data and saying, well, this is a big risk to me, this is a small risk to me. And so then the parties are going back and forth. And the translation, I've read some very inflammatory responses by scientists who, reading it, it seems like they just started smashing on their keyboard and getting something out. And it's very kind of disorienting for the lay public to hear that. And it does, I think it's somewhat unique in the nutrition field because food has such also meaning beyond just a sustenance. It's got cultural meaning. There's also environmental aspects that can be put into there. There's moral aspects as well. Where we don't, like, I spend most of my time with people talking about physical activity. We don't have that kind of, how should I say, that kind of excitement. Maybe we should, so get more people active and stuff. But with nutrition, it's like, you know, if you could just picture you're at a dinner table and you've got 2 guests at the table, one's vegan and one's following the paleo diet. Well, I would imagine there'd be some exciting conversation at that dinner that night.
Scott Lear, you end your piece for theconversation.com with a pretty provocative idea. And you say that we should basically consider stop doing nutrition science until we can get it right. How will we ever get it right if we stop doing it?
Well, there are better ways in which we can assess diet than most studies have been doing. There are suggestions that, especially with most people having a smartphone with a camera in it, taking a picture of what you eat and then analyzing that picture is going to be more accurate than asking people to write down what they ate. Hmm. So there's ways that even now we could do it. There's also, we can work towards doing these randomized trials. And it's not that scientists don't want to do this. They cost a lot. So we need also the funding agencies, the research funding agencies, to say, okay, these are worthwhile studies to fund. Give you an example. When it comes to medications, the companies, the private companies, pay for that research. And because that helps also build their marketing case, but it's also a requirement by the FDA to have this medication approved. We don't have that sort of big pocket private industry that can help support nutrition research. And then also we want to make sure it's in an unbiased fashion.
I was going to say, would you really want the Beef Council funding research on red meat, though?
Well, there are ways that which industry can fund studies, and you keep them at arm's length. And so that's how most of our pharmaceutical trials are done. They're funded by a pharmaceutical agency, but the scientists are not part of the industry. They don't receive their salary from it. They conduct the study, and they publish it regardless of what the results are. Where it can get kind of shady is if, like, the industry is funding the study, but then they have say of whether it gets published or not.
So maybe you're not so much saying let's stop doing nutrition research as let's do more and better nutrition research.
Yes, yeah. And there have been a couple of voices in nutrition science that have started to say, you know, we've got to get this right.
Scott Lear is professor and chair of cardiovascular prevention research at Simon Fraser University, and he's written about the perils of flip-flopping nutritional advice for theconversation.com. Scott, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Heather.
Up next, the opportunities for restoring ocean ecosystems with aquaculture. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Aquaculture is currently the third most lucrative fishery in New England, after lobster and scallops. Oysters and increasingly kelp are two of the most commonly grown species. Now, a new study says aquaculture could also be an important way to address issues like nutrient pollution and habitat loss. In fact, that study found that New England's waters are among the top 20 locations in the world with the greatest opportunities for restorative aquaculture. Seth Tierkoff is an aquaculture scientist with the Nature Conservancy and lead author of that global assessment. Seth, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Let's start with this phrase, restorative aquaculture. Aquaculture is, you know, essentially ocean farming, growing marine species. But what makes it restorative?
Aquaculture, as you mentioned, is one of the fastest growing forms of food production if we look out across the world. So what we know is that when we've looked out across aquaculture's history, we've seen a lot of negative impacts associated with aquaculture development in terms of environmental impacts, in terms of nutrient pollution, and in terms of social impacts, in terms of high-intensity aquaculture sort of in the wrong places and at the wrong levels. But what we're increasingly understanding through scientific research and the growth of aquaculture in certain places is that aquaculture, specifically thinking here about shellfish and seaweed aquaculture, has the potential to actually provide some ecosystem benefits and environmental benefits. And by that, we're specifically referring to the fact that shellfish and seaweeds are sort of at the bottom of the food web, and that they're able to actually take up nutrients from the water column, and through harvest, actually remove those nutrients from the water column.
And it highlights a bit of an irony in that, as you said, we've traditionally seen nutrient pollution coming from primarily finfish aquaculture. But here you're actually saying one of the things it can address is nutrient pollution, because it's a completely different, I guess, setup when you're talking about growing oysters or mussels.
That's correct. So when we're talking about aquaculture, we're really thinking about the production of finfish, shellfish, as well as seaweeds. And so if we're looking across those three categories, what's really interesting and unique as far as sort of an environmental opportunity through aquaculture is the fact that bivalve shellfish are generally filter feeding organisms. So they're actually filtering out phytoplankton from the water column. They're sequestering or taking up those nutrients. And so that's one specific way that we're actually seeing that there's this, you know, unique opportunity for bivalve shellfish and seaweed to provide nutrient pollution mitigation benefits. But there's, in addition to that, as I mentioned, there's this whole realm of research that we're really sort of starting to unlock a deeper understanding of how shellfish and seaweed aquaculture can be a tool to aid ecosystem recovery. And one piece of that is actually around understanding sort of how oysters are further impacting and influencing nutrient dynamics in estuarine systems. And one part of that is a process known as denitrification, which actually is there's variable results out there. But what we're starting to see is that these other processes that are less well known around shellfish and seaweed aquaculture may actually contribute to even greater ecosystem level benefits than previously thought, which is really interesting and exciting.
Another issue that you say, in particular, the kelp and seaweed side of things might help address is the problem of ocean acidification, the change in pH that happens when the ocean absorbs excess carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. What's the story there?
Sure. So this is similar in that there's been a body of research that's really looked at the potential for seaweed farms to provide a localized buffering effect in terms of ocean acidification. And what's really interesting is that seaweed is a photosynthetic organism. And so actually through photosynthesis, seaweeds are taking up carbon dioxide, and they're basically preventing, to a certain extent, that carbon dioxide from converting into carbonic acid, which is what leads to ocean acidification. So we're beginning to get a sense that seaweed farms could be able to provide some localized benefits in terms of reducing the impacts of ocean acidification.
And that has an interesting synergy with the shellfish aquaculture because, of course, shellfish are in the process of trying to build their shells, they're very much affected by the pH of the ocean.
That's correct. And so there's the potential, as you're alluding to, in terms of co-benefits, in terms of culturing shellfish and seaweeds together. There's been a whole sort of realm of research for the last few decades or more around this idea of integrated multi-trophic aquaculture, which is really just a big phrase way of saying farming multiple species in the same place at the same time. And we've known in terms of some of the sort of the nutrient dynamics and habitat value of aquaculture, that culturing multiple species at the same time can lead to some sort of symbiotic, mutualistic type relationships amongst those cultured species that can provide benefits to those species that are being cultured, but also potentially greater environmental benefits in terms of all of those ecosystem services that I mentioned earlier.
Well, Seth Tierkoff, in this new analysis of aquaculture opportunities around the globe, you do consider nutrient pollution and ocean acidification that we've talked about. Also the fact that, of course, aquaculture can relieve fishing pressure on wild populations. But then there's this last piece, which is habitat restoration. And I have to say, if I think about this in a land-based analogy, right, I don't think of farming as habitat restoration. It's not rebuilding forests or natural fields. So how could aquaculture be part of habitat restoration within the ocean?
So we've really learned that shellfish can provide habitat value in a number of ways. And so specific to shellfish aquaculture, we have a number of projects that are ongoing in the U.S., in Massachusetts, as well as in Washington State, that are utilizing GoPro cameras to actually quantify what is the level of fish and invertebrate habitat utilization of this shellfish gear in the species relative to nearby adjacent reference sites. And it's interesting because what we're realizing is that certain practices actually are able to provide enhanced habitat value. So certain types of gear, like floating gear, which in general can consist of these sort of large cages or baskets or bags that are sort of an open mesh design actually allow juvenile fish to enter those cages and provides a certain level of refuge from predatory fish. That gear actually provides structure for fouling organisms. So things like you would see on a dock or a piling, that actually can provide an additional food resource for fish and invertebrate species. And then there's other benefits that we're sort of unlocking as we speak through this active research. So it's really thinking about aquaculture in a different way and really trying to understand not just what are the impacts when done poorly, but when done well, what could be and what are some of the benefits that we could expect.
Well, Seth Tierkoff, in this new global assessment that you've done, the goal was to find where are the places in the world where the opportunities for benefits might be the greatest. Is that simply a matter of identifying the places where these problems of habitat loss, of overfishing, nutrient pollution, ocean acidification, where those are the worst? Or are there other factors that go into forming a great opportunity spot?
That's a great question. And that's actually the approach that we took. So we looked across a number of different environmental challenges and sort of flipped the book on them, flipped the lens on them, and looked at them as an opportunity where if shellfish and seaweed aquaculture were to develop and to develop well, which we talk further in the paper about what that means to have done it well. But looking at where those challenges are the greatest and viewing those as the areas where shellfish and seaweed aquaculture development could provide the greatest benefit. So in addition to that, we sort of took it to the next step and thought more about sort of the socioeconomic enabling conditions, as well as the sort of human health factors that are important. You know, we're talking here about the social context under which shellfish and seaweed aquaculture could develop in these regions.
Like whether it's well-regulated, whether there are processing plants, that sort of thing?
Precisely. So we incorporated factors around governance, food security, considerations around wastewater treatment prevalence within the regions, and a number of other factors like that that really sort of get at where are the enabling conditions greatest for shellfish and seaweed aquaculture to provide the greatest environmental benefit, but also social benefit as well.
New England's waters, and in fact, the entire east coast of the U.S., comes out as one of the top regions of opportunity globally. What is the mix of conditions that puts it in that top 20?
What we see is that along the east coast of the United States, and in particular in New England, there's a number of challenges around nutrient pollution, around loss of coastal habitats, as I mentioned, as well as challenges around fishing pressure and ocean acidification. And so when we pair those environmental challenges with the sort of social opportunity in terms of the quality of governance, logistical factors, as well as the sort of human health enabling conditions, there's really a significant opportunity that's emerged in the East Coast, and in particular in the New England region, for continued development of shellfish and seaweed aquaculture to provide those benefits that I mentioned.
Seth Tierkoff, when you look around the world, where are some of those other regions of opportunity, and what makes them so ripe for development of aquaculture?
So in terms of the highest priority regions for development of shellfish and seaweed aquaculture to provide those environmental and social benefits, we found the opportunities to be greatest throughout Europe, Australia, North America, as well as parts of Asia and South America. But what that really tells us is that the opportunity is truly global in terms of there is not just one specific region of the world where this opportunity is greatest. There's opportunity distributed throughout the world for development of these types of aquaculture to provide those benefits.
Seth Tierkoff is an aquaculture scientist with the Nature Conservancy and lead author on a new global assessment of the opportunities for shellfish and seaweed farming to improve the environment while providing food and jobs. Seth, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. The 2020 census is going digital. We recently brought you a story of how this technological innovation could lead to undercounting Native Americans who live on tribal land. Today, we're flipping that equation. And rather than looking at how computer technology is affecting the census, we're asking how the census has affected the development of computer technology. Hermann Hollerith is considered one of the forefathers of modern computing. He invented the first punch card reader, and he did that to make analyzing census data easier. David Lindsay Roberts is an adjunct professor of mathematics at Prince George's Community College, and the story of Hermann Hollerith is one of nearly two dozen featured in his new book, Republic of Numbers, Unexpected Stories of Mathematical Americans Through History. David, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I have to say, I typically associate the birth of computer technology with World War II, but that's actually the transition from punch card reader to computer. You say the story of actually getting started on this goes back to the census of 1880, which was apparently a real beast. It took 8 years to analyze the data. What was going on?
That's correct. It was simply a matter that the amount of information that was being collected, and this was being collected manually, written up on tally sheets and so on from all over the country, and then brought into into Washington, D.C., into a sort of army of clerks who were tabulating this stuff, and they had very little in the way of automated help to do this. It was all pretty much just done by hand, and it simply was becoming overwhelming because the population of the country was continuing to grow at a rapid pace.
And it wasn't just the population growth. They were doing more, as the census does today, more than just counting the number of people. They were starting to collect various demographic data as well.
That's correct, yes. The Constitution requires the census, and the Constitution doesn't really say too much more than that. The one thing that it's clear on is that the census is to be used for apportioning the seats in the House of Representatives. The more populous states get more seats.
Right.
But from very early on, it was felt desirable to ask many more questions than just, how many people are in this state? And I make a point of saying that one of the very initial complicating factors was the slavery issue, because the Constitution did, in fact, make it a clear distinction between what they called free people and everybody else. And these other people were, of course, the slaves. And so there was a necessity to make at least that distinction. But in addition to this, there were other distinctions, other demographic categories that were very soon being investigated. And this was becoming more and more the case as the 19th century wore on.
And do we have a sense of how accurate those census figures were? I mean, I can just imagine people going through stacks and stacks and stacks of these handwritten census documents. It's mind-numbing, and potentially
yes.
You get a little careless in there.
Yes, I'm sure that they did. I don't really know of any clear assessment of how accurate these early censuses were.
You'd probably want a computer to do that, and they didn't have them.
that's right, yes.
So David Lindsay Roberts, the story you tell in Republic of Numbers is that of Hermann Hollerith, who I guess starts in this story as a mechanical engineer who was assisting with the census. Who was he, and why was a mechanical engineer assisting with the census in the first place?
He was a graduate of the Columbia School of Mines, just a young man at the time that he became involved with the census. I shouldn't say that there was no mechanical assistance to the census. There were some efforts to try to do something as far as making the tally sheets regular in shape and form, and having a good printing operations that could be used to produce the tally sheets and so on. So there was some need for some fairly low level mechanical engineering that was already recognized. And he was just sort of hanging around. One of his professors at the Columbia School of Mines, a fellow named Trowbridge, had already been involved with the census to some degree, and I think it was through him that Hollerith first got involved.
So between the 1880 census, as they're working their way through 8 years of data analysis on that, they're also prepping for the 1890 census. And by 1890, Hollerith has essentially a punch card system ready to launch. I mean, does that seem fast? To go from nothing to a punch card system?
The recognition that there was going to be a problem with the 1890 census came relatively early. I think Hollerith actually got involved in this as early as 1884, when he was encouraged by one of his associates there at the census to start thinking about what can we possibly do to improve things, and so he was starting to think about these things well before 1890.
But still, we're talking about a punch card system, and the census agents weren't going out with a punch card and a hole punch, right? I mean, somebody still had to translate documents into punch cards.
There was still a lot of one-on-one activity involved with the census. If you translate, once you translated the card or the tally sheets, the handwritten tally sheets, onto the cards, then it became possible to, and the cards were sturdy enough that they could be used over and over again, then it became possible to do multiple computations, calculations with these sets of cards that simply hadn't been possible previously.
And how much of a difference did that make? I mean, 8 years to analyze the 1880 census. What are we talking about in 1890?
Yeah, the one fact that I was able to uncover was that already by November of 1890, they had enough initial data tabulated that they were able to estimate, which state should get how many representatives.
So from years to months.
That's correct, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, David Lindsay Roberts, there's a follow-on story to this, which is that Hollerith goes on to keep working in the punch card arena, starts a company, and that ends up becoming IBM eventually after he retires, but it ends up becoming
right.
IBM. Did he have a sense of where his punch card reader could lead?
I think he did have some notion of this, that he's quite proud of his invention, and he was I think aware that it could lead to some greater feats, but I don't think he conceived of the modern computer industry as we know it today.
Well, and it took a long time to get there after this 5-6 year period, 1884 to 1890, to invent the punch card reader, and then by 1950, they're still doing the census with a punch card reader. And you, in fact, quote computer pioneer Grace Murray Hopper as saying that people at that point thought they would be using punch card readers forever. They still hadn't really conceived of modern computing.
Yes, that's right. And I mean, I myself was using computers in the 1970s and 1980s. And even then, card readers was still one of the primary ways to enter data into a computer, or enter a program into a computer, was still by means of punched cards. People that have grown up since that time just don't realize this fact.
And of course, that is what eventually did lead to what we now would think of more as something more recognizable as a modern computer.
That's right, yes. The post-war computers, the 50s and 60s, were, gigantic room-filling machines that would, dwarf anything that we have now.
Well, David Lindsay Roberts, you've written this book that is basically biographical sketches of about two dozen different mathematically inclined people in the history of the U.S. Where does Hollerith fit in that? I mean, what was so obviously, he's a mechanical engineer. There's math involved in that. But was he a mathematician, per se?
No, he wasn't really a mathematician. And I guess what my interest in him is almost the fact that his contribution was not really initially very mathematical. All he was doing mathematically was simply enhancing the ability to count things. There's nothing very sophisticated about this compared to advanced mathematics. But ultimately, the computer, which in part, as I argue, comes out of his punch card machines, ultimately the computer has had a very profound effect on mathematics at all levels. And from teaching the subject to at elementary levels to the most advanced theoretical mathematics.
So not terribly heroic, not high-level mathematics, and yet incredibly important. Do you think that there's a lesson in that type of story, a broader lesson in that?
Well, I guess in my conversations with people about the history of mathematics, they sometimes have a notion that, you know, mathematics is sort of an all or nothing thing. Either you get it right away, you can solve the problem in 5 seconds, or else you can't solve it at all.
You're a genius or you're a dunce, and there's no in between.
This is a terrible problem in education, where it's very hard to convince students. Often, in my experience, to understand that, you know, there are problems that are worth thinking about for a long period of time. And you know, students think a long period of time is, you know, 5 minutes sometimes. And they really can't conceive of a mathematician, for example, working on a single problem for years, which does happen. And so it is, I think, important that I try in the book, and in my teaching, for that matter, to get people to understand this a little bit more, that there are some problems that simply take a while.
That's David Lindsay Roberts. His book is Republic of Numbers, Unexpected Stories of Mathematical Americans Through History. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Up next, climate change is a serious problem, but comedy could help us talk about it. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Think climate change is too serious to joke about? Well, consider this. With each new scientific report, the situation seems to get more dire. But the social and political will to address the issue has lagged. For years, scientists and communicators thought the problem was that the facts weren't getting through to the public. But years of research suggest the obstacle may be more fundamental, an issue of how we talk about climate change and science more broadly. And that has led some researchers to experiment with some pretty unorthodox ways to break through the inertia and polarization surrounding climate change. For example,
you know the way those scientists are always trying to pull a fast one on us? Oh, you rapscallions. Fool me once, and then prove it over and over and over again, and have it reviewed by your peers until it's a fact.
Max Boykoff is an associate professor of environmental studies and director of the Center for Science and Technology Policy Research at the University of Colorado Boulder. He's also author of Creative Climate Communications. Max, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me on the show.
You've been studying climate communication for about 20 years. And if we go back about 20 years, a lot of what was being said about climate change communication was scientists are failing to get enough facts across to the American public. That's what is going wrong in this process, and we've got to do better at communicating the facts. At what point did you realize that hammering home facts and really dire worst-case scenarios about climate change was, in fact, not working and was barking up the wrong tree to some extent?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I learned that fairly early in the work that I did. I started to investigate these issues from a social sciences perspective. And just as you're saying, it's this notion of information deficit that people would cling to, thinking that if we just could give them some more facts, throw out some more reports into the public space, that everyone's going to do the right thing. But I learned, I think, pretty early that we live complex lives. We're complex people. And so that is what, you know, motivated me in part to start to then investigate for the last nearly 20 years how to more effectively communicate and essentially connect with people under different conditions and with different audiences.
And you point out that there's been another side effect of ineffective climate communication besides the fact that decades later we are still not where we should be in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions or even having the degree of consensus that one might expect among the American public that climate change is happening and is human caused. That besides that main effect of ineffective climate communication, there's been a secondary effect, which is kind of a social acceptance of not talking about climate change at all.
Mm-hmm. You're right. I mean, there are many effects. There isn't just the one secondary effect, of course, but that's a big one. We have retreated into these spaces of virtual climate silence. And in the United States context in particular, this is often a partisan, polarized issue. And so people tend to avoid those sorts of things. But we've allowed ourselves to avoid what turns out to be one of the greatest, most challenging issues of our time in the 21st century. And so it is there is this real need for this movement from that 20th century model of communication that you had described well in your previous question, which is hitting people over the head with facts and science, into a 21st century communications model, which is dialogue, which starts with conversation, starts with listening to other points of view and opening up new pathways to understanding and engaging with these issues. And so that can be experiential. Talking with people about how they've experienced a changing climate during their lives. It can be through aesthetics, engaging more with the arts in the creative spaces. It can be through emotions and affective ways of learning and knowing. That's actually been an area that I've been collaborating with others on to understand how humor perhaps can leverage these spaces to open up conversations and lower defenses and get people talking about it as a vehicle for greater engagement in action.
Max Boykoff, as you describe those different kind of modes of communication, experiential, emotional, do you see that as separate from scientific, or is there a way to combine those two to talk about climate science in an experiential or an emotional way? How connected are they?
Yeah, they're absolutely connected. I think it's a mistake to think of them as completely separate, because the way in which we understand a changing climate largely comes from the great work that's been done over the last decades within the sciences. It's really to complement and then help that work go farther. In the book, I talk about 10 different kind of features of a roadmap and rules of the road, essentially guidance on how we can smarten up the way that we talk about climate change in order to improve the effectiveness of greater engagement. And Steve Schneider, who was a really successful climate communicator in his lifetime, who was at Stanford University for a long time, the National Center for Atmospheric Research, he basically summed it up in terms of knowing thy audience, knowing thyself, but knowing thy stuff. And so we definitely don't want to separate out all of this scientific information from these other pathways that I described. In fact, they can help support and fortify and enrich those discussions.
When it comes to knowing thy audience, does that mean that it is possible to get a climate change message through to anyone if you use the right approach? I mean, I think the thinking, the prevailing wisdom has almost become at this point that there are certain people, certain groups of people for whom climate change is just never going to resonate. It's not going to work. Do you think that's true, or is that just a blind spot in our communication strategies?
I think there's always a pathway in. For people who may have seen the book, you'll have seen that climate in the title of Creative Climate Communications is in parentheses. I do that for two reasons. One, I wrote it as a book that can be about creative communications about other science and policy issues. But to your question, secondly, I wrote it because sometimes effective communications and creative communications may involve not invoking the terms climate or climate change explicitly. Hmm. We know probably in our own lives that sometimes those raise people's defenses. Instead, there are many other ways that you can talk about this issue. And this is in no way to suggest that we shy away from confronting this challenge. In fact, the scale of the response collectively to date is nowhere near commensurate to the scale of the challenge that we're facing. But we can talk about this in other ways, like resilience, like stewardship of our planet. And that can open up pathways to talking about it through religion, for instance. We can talk about it through what kind of legacy do we want to leave for future generations. We can talk about it through local air and water quality. Talk about it, I think, importantly, through public health and the health of our kids. I even think that we could start productive conversations with people who you describe who may not want to have a conversation about climate change, about patriotism and about lessening our reliance on foreign carbon-based energy fuel sources as one pathway towards decarbonization. This can be then cloaked in the language of national security and energy security as well. The list can go on and on, but I just gave you probably a number of ways that people can get to those discussions about climate change by not necessarily invoking it and then having people shut down.
When we think about who can use creative climate communication strategies, whether it's, you know, addressing people's religious values or their place-based concerns and values, or using a little bit more comedy. At one point in the introduction to your book, Creative Climate Communications, you almost kind of juxtapose media coverage with creative climate communication. Do you think that those two are mutually exclusive? Are these tools that the media could be using to perhaps reach new or broader audiences, or reach their audiences more effectively?
I do. Yeah. And I appreciate you making that connection. I've written this as a handbook or a guide. We're in a really different place than we were nearly 20 years ago, where there's so much great social sciences and humanities research that's going on that can help inform how, say, news media, for instance, can smarten up the way that they communicate about climate change and be more creative about that. There is this well-worn path of reporting on the latest scientific finding, but there are all these other underutilized paths. And it points to kind of one of the main arguments that I put forward in the book, is that there isn't a silver bullet to any of these communications. Instead, it's more of a silver buckshot approach that's needed to reach different audiences in different contexts. And so media actors can certainly, those people who are communicating through media can certainly use this. I hope they find it useful. Also, policy decision makers can find this of use. Anyone really who wants to contribute in this world and make a difference in the lives and in their communities, I hope will find this to be useful.
It's interesting that you use that phrase, there's no silver bullet, there's a silver buckshot of opportunities, because the same thing tends to be said about the technological potential solutions for climate change, that there's no one silver bullet. We're going to need a lot of different technologies and solutions. Do you think that is a unique aspect of the climate change challenge, and why we've had such a hard time both communicating about it effectively and actually getting collective action to address climate change going?
I don't think it is unique. I think it's a good question to ask, but I think it's been the case with many critical issues that we've seen in the past that can help guide the way we engage with this set of critical and intersectional issues now. You know, looking to the past, there was no silver bullet, so to speak, that helped push for women's rights, that helped push for gay rights in the public arena, that helped push for racial equality. I mean, I guess I'm just giving some social examples, but it was a lot of work done by many different people in a variety of ways, using a variety of tactics and strategies. And so I really don't think that climate change is different. It is unique in other ways, in that it is the kind of issue that permeates just about every aspect of our lives, the way that we live, work, get around, relax, play. But I still think that we can learn from some of these past movements for change and movements for societal improvement to learn from them and more capably then address climate change.
Max Boykoff is an associate professor of environmental studies and director of the Center for Science and Technology Policy Research at the University of Colorado Boulder and author of Creative Climate Communications. Max, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.